revenue to order, and our chair is otherwise occupied for about 15 minutes, and then he'll be here, so we're going to go ahead without him. We'll start up with Senate Bill 784. Kyle, can you tell us what that's about?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 784 creates an income tax subtraction that'll be, it's available in instances where crop loss occurs due to non-arson-related fire. And the amount of the subtraction is equal to the potential market value of the crop that is lost at time of harvest, minus any amount that's received from insurance settlement or other payment related to the loss of the crop. And the subtraction is available in tax years 2020 through 2025. And this is personal or corporate income tax subtraction.
Senator Hansel, would you join us? And Blake also.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 784. As someone who comes from a farming background, I'm proud to support this legislation. After a devastating fire season last year, several potential policy changes became clear. The substation fire near the Dalles was the largest burning wildfire in the United States for a period of time last summer, and burned 80,000 acres total, but hundreds of or tens of thousands of cropland. Senate Bill 784 will allow farmers who suffer from crop loss due to fire to reduce their taxable income by the amount of their crop loss that is not covered by insurance. The legislation offers an opportunity for farmers to recover some of their losses due to no fault of their own. As the farming industry becomes more complex and challenging, we need to do everything we can to support the Oregon farmers. The Oregon Wheat Growers League has submitted testimony to support this bill, and I'm honored to share the podium today with its executive director. Thank you for your time, and I urge an aye vote. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Blake, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Blake Rowe. I'm the CEO for the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and it is a pleasure to be with you. So, Vice Chair Bentz and members of the committee, we would very much rise in support of Senate Bill 784. Very appreciative of Senator Hansel and the other sponsors of the bill. This will be a great help to growers who suffer losses. So obviously fires become a major concern across much of Oregon, and this was especially true in 2018. Many of our dryland wheat growers across the plateau suffered devastating losses to their operations, not just what was turning out to be a very good, high quality, high volume wheat crop, but also losses to their homes, their outbuildings, their fences, critical vegetative cover to protect their soil. Worst of all, obviously, we lost a farmer in the substation fire. In many of those areas, our growers were actually the first ones on scene. At their own cost, they worked side by side with the firefighting crews for days, if not weeks, using their own equipment, their own knowledge of the ground to make a difference and help contain the fires and protect their communities. Now, many farmers take full advantage of the product we call crop insurance, that is through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and some take other types of coverage to help them recover from fire losses. But those things are not intended to make them whole. The concept of crop insurance is really there to ensure that they can survive to the next year and get a crop in the ground. There really is no provision beyond that, and that, I think, is the intent of this bill, is to give them a little bit more recognition and a little bit more coverage for the loss from fire. So as the bill is laid out, it would look at the difference between the market value of the crop lost and whatever insurance coverage was available, and that would be the amount that would be available for deduction on their against their income. Again, it's a big help to farmers who are trying to recover, and we certainly hope that you will move the bill forward and support 784.
Thank you. Questions for the panel?
Yes.
Senator.
Thank you. I just wonder how the value of the crop would be determined.
So the I believe the bill delegates that determination, the actual methodology to, excuse me, Vice Chair Benz, Senator Riley. The bill delegates that to the Department of Revenue to strike the methodology. They could do something very similar to what is used for crop insurance or other insurance purposes, where they base it on the market value at the time of harvest. There's an estimate of volume, which you may or may not know volume if the crop was lost. There are methods that are pretty well established that are already in use, and I would suggest that the state follow those to set value. It's survey the market. You could even rely somewhat on what USDA does in the National Statistics Service.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Benz. So I just wanted to understand about the crop insurance and about how much does it usually cover? I have no sense of that.
So Vice Chair Benz, Senator Taylor. Crop insurance is a pretty flexible program in that the grower decides the level of coverage, the percentage of full value that they want to cover. You can never buy 100% coverage.
Okay.
But it's based really on your assessment of risk and how much you're willing to pay. Obviously, the higher percentage of value, if you want a 60% coverage, it costs you more than if you take 40% coverage. So it's a sliding scale, and the premium obviously costs the grower more for the higher value that they choose. That's why it's a little hard to tell you definitely it covers exactly this and it costs exactly this much.
Okay.
'Cause they have some choice in that.
So how would it intersect then between the decision somebody made for the crop insurance and then having this program through the state? I mean, you had said it would be on top of it because you can never get the full replacement.
I'm just trying to understand.
How it would stack. I mean, this would be the person would get their insurance first, and then they would come to the state.
Correct. You would have to know what the insurance settlement, if you had coverage, what your coverage settlement would be before you could do this. Usually those things would have played out before you got around to filing your taxes, which would be the, in the following year that you, from when you had the loss. So those would be knowns, and you could do the math.
I take it crop insurance is not a mandate?
Vice Chair Benz, Senator Taylor, no. But Oregon is one of the states that the percentage of growers, at least on the wheat growers, that take coverage is very high. It's probably in excess of 85% of growers who do elect to carry crop insurance coverage.
Okay, thank you.
Would you have any objection to putting in this bill a requirement that they actually carry that insurance? I mean, because obviously you can just say, well, I don't have to carry it because the state's going to bail me out.
Vice Chair Benz, I probably would say no. I doubt the growers would want that just because the crop insurance is a choice. Now they can elect to take it or not to take it. Some don't. Some don't because of the size of their operation or, for whatever. So I would actually, to give you an answer to that, I would have to ask the farmers. I don't know how they feel about that. And this is a deduction against income. So it's really somewhat reflective of your state tax rate, what you actually would net in terms of benefit. Not complaining, but it's not quite the same as a credit against your taxes. It's a credit against your income. So, like I said, it doesn't get you to back to full, but it does help.
Right. So, let's go back to, I think I read this morning that the president's budget reduces the percentage of insurance that's going to be offered, assuming that that budget were adopted, from, I want to say, 60% down to 40. Has that been discussed yet?
Vice Chair Benz, I guess my answer would be no. It hasn't really been discussed at the national level, but at the national level, pretty much all of the major crop groups have already objected to the House and Senate Ag Committees that would actually see that proposal from the president. I doubt that. It's not the first time that President Trump has proposed those kinds of cuts, and they went nowhere before, so I doubt they will change.
And the market value, if assuming one had the federal crop insurance, is it incumbent upon the farmer then to produce that market value number so it would be the same number for one purpose as for the other?
No, Vice Chair Benz, the USDA actually does market surveys to establish the value of wheat, harvestable wheat. The grower would have the burden either through their historic production records or if they had actually had an estimate of their crop, they would have to help establish the volume of the crop that was lost. But again, that happens already under if you lose your crop and it's covered by crop insurance. So there are methods to establish volume, but they survey the market every year to establish price.
My question actually was, you would have to go through the exercise you just described in order to apply for your federal benefit or recovery.
Yes.
And thus, correct. Would you use the same numbers for your application to the state?
I would recommend that. I would recommend that the state adopt that kind of methodology, but the bill doesn't specify that. It says that the Department of Revenue or Department of Ag has to establish the method.
I'm sorry. I'll look it up.
That would be my recommendation to them. Don't reinvent the wheel, but what up to them to establish the methodology.
And to give us a sense of scale, any idea of how many dollars of loss were incurred in the fire that was referenced earlier in the presentation?
So the substation fire?
Yeah.
So Vice Chair Benz, our estimate was that we lost between one and two. So I have to do a little bit of a math chain. So 1 to 2 million bushels of wheat were lost. So let's take 1 million bushels at farm gate value of $5 to keep it simple would be a total loss of $5 million. If you had 50% crop insurance coverage, that would be $2.5 million from the substation fire. There's a lot of assumptions to get to that number, but it gives you a ballpark.
And Kyle, for purposes of figuring out what that would cost the state, if someone used that as a subtraction, you could assume a tax rate of
9.
Mr. Vice Chair, it's going to vary certainly by the farmer and even the type of farmer. Many farmers have losses in individual years and then gains, but in many cases, the 9% marginal tax rate is that one that individuals get to if they have, if they are profitable that year.
So keeping in consistent with the incredibly rough numbers we're using here, you'd take 9% of $2.5 million. That'd be roughly the cost to the state of the program.
A starting point, yeah.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Benz, it's Department of Revenue in the bill.
I'm sorry, Department of Revenue. Thank you.
Yeah.
Further questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 784 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 785. And it is Jamie. I made a mistake, didn't I? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 785 and reopen Senate Bill 784 and allow Marcia Kelly to testify. Sorry, Marcia, this acting as chair is very unfamiliar to me.
That's okay. I'm not shy about getting up and saying some things. Vice Chair Benz, Senator Riley, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. One of the tenets of capitalism is that as an owner, you have both risks and opportunities. And in this case, we're talking about farmers. There are lots of risks that farmers face between weather and other natural disasters. So as a prudent business person, one would consider having insurance to cover your businesses, and I would assume that that would be a prudent farmer would have crop insurance. Now, the gentleman before us said that probably 85% of their farms had insurance, but what about the other 15% that did not? This bill could be an incentive to not get crop insurance if the state of Oregon is going to assume the risk for the farmers if there's a fire or other disaster. It's not a single case. This bill would be in effect through 2026, so it's not just one hit for the wheat farmer loss in Eastern Oregon in 2018. And we are concerned about the loss of life, but we're also concerned about the lives of other Oregonians and what this would do as we continually erode the tax base for our income taxes. I have attached a section dealing with natural resources, putting all the natural resources tax credits together from the tax expenditure report, and highlighted the yellow ones that would most likely affect people who have crops, because this is not just talking about the wheat farmers in Eastern Oregon, it's any crop that would be considered by fire. So you have to take that into consideration too as you're looking at tax credits. We sincerely hope that you leave the income tax base as solid as it can be and not add any additional tax credits.
Thank you. Questions?
No, I just was checking. It's not a credit, it is a deduction.
Excuse me, it's a subtraction, but it still is eroding by 9%.
Yeah, by 9%, yes.
And that's not just for the one loss that we're talking about. It also could affect people in Southern Oregon whose crops may have been damaged. Been damaged by the fires there. So we're looking at more than just a little nose under the tent.
So you would say that the word fire includes smoke damage to grapes? Is that what you're thinking?
I would think that that's how insurance companies might, when you have a household fire and there is smoke damage, that's oftentimes covered with insurance. I think there are also insurance out there besides the federal insurance, but I couldn't get any quotes back from anyone on a short basis on what it would cost. But I think smoke would be considered too.
Further questions, Marcia? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 784? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 784 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 785. Jamie, tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Senator Benz, members of the committee. Senate Bill 785, just a little background on the bill, and I there are some companies that are based in Idaho or Washington, and they provide boat tours to people along the river. This bill specifically deals with jet boats, and sometimes these boats stop in Oregon docks or parks, but are generally on the common waterway. And so this bill would exclude from central assessment under 308.515 and taxation a company that its property and its property if a jet boat excursion company that operates partially on the shared waterways of Columbia or Snake River but is not itself a company that's located in Oregon.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vince and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29 in Northeast Oregon, which also on my eastern border borders the Snake River. And it was because of that where it comes into Wallowa County almost exclusively that I was contacted. I introduced 785 after meeting with jet boat operators who run excursions on the Snake and Columbia River. These folks are based primarily in Lewiston, Idaho, some in Clarkston, Idaho. Currently, jet boat operators from out of state are subject to Oregon property taxes, even though their businesses are out of state. Well, I was told that they'd been operating for years and all of a sudden got a property tax bill from the state of Oregon when their property isn't in Oregon at all. But because they were operating on the river and came ashore for a picnic or an excursion or to swim or whatever. So this would legislation would add jet boat operators to ORS 308.515 and allow them to be exempted from Oregon property taxes. Currently, rafting, dredging, marine salvage, and guide services such as fishing expeditions are exempted from Oregon property tax under state law if they are headquartered out of state. The jet boat tour is an important part of tourism economy for northeastern Oregon. It is important to note that this legislation only exempts out-of-state jet boat operators from Oregon property tax. They are still subject to the fees and permits associated with using Oregon state parks and day use areas for commercial purposes. My office will work to if you wish, the revenue impact that we'll submit to the committee. But my estimate is that the legislation will impact fewer than five businesses and won't have any significant revenue impact. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Well, I have one. I've actually gone down that river on a jet boat from Hell's Canyon Dam, I think, whichever one is the lowest one, on into Lewiston. And there's a lot of river that's bordered by Oregon on one side, Idaho on the other, and eventually you get to Washington. Is the thought here that the boat's presence in that river doesn't lend itself to being here adequately to warrant a property tax? Is that the thought?
Correct. The river itself is, you call it what kind of waterway? It was
it's common between the
common,
two states.
Common waterway between the two states. But my understanding is the property tax that was levied is for their place in Lewiston. And the boats kind of go back and forth occasionally. They'll stop, for whatever, on the tour itself, or maybe the channel takes them more over into the Oregon side. Just seemed to be a fairness issue. And we exempt other types of marine usage on the same waterway, and that a jet boat tour, folks based in Lewiston or Clarkston shouldn't, that they qualify for the same reasons why we exempt the other businesses or types.
Thank you.
Can someone tell me what other businesses are exempt?
Vice Chair Benz, Senator Riley, on ORS 308.515, currently rafting, dredging, marine salvage, guide services such as fishing expeditions are exempt from Oregon property taxes. Under the state law, if they are headquartered out of state.
And so jet boat tours are different than other boat tours, is that?
Senator Wright, all I know is they got a notice from the Oregon Department of Revenue. They had to pay property tax on their headquarters in Lewiston, Idaho.
Okay, thank you.
I'm trying to clarify that up, that they shouldn't, my feeling is they shouldn't be charged.
Sounds like that to me. Yeah. Okay.
You want to have the Department of Revenue come up and tell us about jet boats?
If that would be helpful to you, that would be great.
See them in the back.
Yes,
please.
Chair Benz, members of the committee, Mark Arce with the Department of Revenue. I think Senator Hansel pretty much hit the nail on the head there. We do tax We do tax transportation, water transportation companies that operate on inland waters. And we have been taxing other jet boat companies for some time, including companies that are headquartered in Washington State. But we were doing a look at to make sure that we had been complete in our list of who we were picking up and who we weren't. And we discovered that this company was not being centrally assessed. And so we did send them a letter, had some communications with their attorney, and that's where the bill comes from. So I think the statutes, I think we're doing the right thing according to the statutes, but certainly neutral on the policy if you guys want to change that. We think that there are maybe 4 to 5 companies, pretty similar to what Senator Hansel said, statewide, that would be affected, and I don't expect that it would be a tremendous amount of money. We don't tax them on their entire value. We have an administrative rule that looks at the number of miles that they're in Oregon versus outside of Oregon, trips in Oregon versus outside of Oregon, and so we tax them on a fraction of what the value of the boats are. So other types of properties are accepted from central assessment under a couple different statutes. Guide boats are an example, but this is not really a guide boat. They're not doing fishing guides. It's just, you know, excursions, transport. But there are lots of other boats out there that we are taxing that do similar excursions on inland waters. So it's not unusual, but I mean, it's really just a policy question for you, I think.
So if we had a boat that belongs to some other state company and it's on a inner waterway, we would tax that 100%. We would tax that at being 100% of the time in our water and tax that company wherever they exist.
Chair Bentz, Senator Riley, I don't think so. I think that what we're looking at is the number of stops that they make in this state and in the other state. And then we use that, again, per an administrative rule, we use that as to determine a ratio of what percentage of the boat is subject to taxation in Oregon, is my understanding.
Follow up. So the question is, if they were on the Willamette River,
mm-hmm.
What percentage of that boat would be taxed?
Sure, Ben, Senator Riley, I think that would be 100%.
That was
right.
My question.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the key is how many times they tie up on the Oregon side. So I recall when we went down the river, we only tied up on the Idaho side, oddly enough. I think we only stopped twice. But would that mean they'd be exempt or they just chose to tie up just on the Idaho side?
No.
Chair Bentz, I think that's right. I think they wouldn't be subject to central assessment if that boat never made its way into Oregon. And I understand that the hook here, if you will, was that they had they would regularly tie up in Oregon in order to get permits. So I think that they tied up in order to get their Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area permits. So that's where the office was, so they're tying up there, at least for that purpose.
Thank you, and I see our chair has returned.
Thank you, Senator Bentz. Senator Riley.
So my understanding of waterways is that somewhere in the middle is where the state stops. One state stops and the other stops. Idaho doesn't come all the way to our shore. Oregon doesn't go all the way to their shore. It's in the middle. So they would be in Oregon anytime they came past halfway. Is that, I want to know if that's true or if it stops.
Chair Bentz or Chair Hass and Senator Riley, that's a little bit beyond my understanding, honestly, my level of detail. I know that we looked at stops. I don't know that we, and the rule makes a reference to trip miles, but I don't know if we actually stop counting trip miles in the middle of the river or if it's any trip that comes to Oregon, the whole trip counts. I don't actually know that answer.
Okay.
I can get it for you, though, for
Thank
sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Chair Hass, I think what the rule says, any river miles that you are in Oregon are potentially accessible,
mm-hmm.
and certainly the stops. And so you come in on,
Okay.
I don't know how you It'd be pretty hard to determine.
So, Senator Riley.
So do we know if Washington and Idaho do the same thing with our boats?
Chair Hatt, Senator Riley, I don't know.
That'd be a good thing to know as well.
Yeah, that for you as well.
Chair Hatt, if I may, in answer to Senator Riley's, on the Oregon side, there are no communities that of the river as you come out of Idaho, as you come into the Hell's Canyon from the north. So in this case, at least for this part of the river, which the bill focuses, we would not be in a position to tax anybody because we don't have, others wouldn't tax us. We don't have any.
Understand, but we have other rivers. We have the Columbia also. I just want to know what the procedure is with other states. And Idaho has also a river touching other states. So I don't know. I just wanted to know if that is something other states do.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We have no one else signed up to testify on this bill. We'll gather some more information on it. Close that public hearing. And then open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 850. Jamie.
Thank you, Chair Hatt, members of the committee. So Senate Bill 850, the original bill instructed the Department of Revenue to conduct a study regarding property tax exemptions on specific airports. That bill, the dash one, now removes the requirement of the study from the bill and exempts the runway of a privately owned airport that has public use in Eastern Oregon that supports emergency services and makes available public use as the condition of a grant.
Okay. Senator Benz.
Chair.
Cliff Benz, State Senator, District 30. I was asked by Mr. Campbell, who joins me here today, owner of the Sisters Airport, to bring this bill. And we've spent a considerable amount of time working with Mr. Campbell, having him put together the justifications for his request. And so I'm going to leave it to him to explain why his airport is entitled to the, or perhaps eligible for, a property tax reduction or exemption by virtue of the public purposes it serves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the Capitol.
Thank you.
Yep. Chairman Hatt, members of the committee, I'm David Campbell. I'm not the owner of the airport. I'm simply an employee. So I've taken this project on behalf of the Sisters Airport. A quick history of Sisters, and it's very quick. Established 1933 by the Forest Service and the Triple C folks, mostly for forestry, bug spraying, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The current owners purchased it in 2011 as a failed airport. And failed airport, if you look at the second page of the handout, is why it's failed, big cracks, so on and so forth. In 2012, the airport applied for a Connect Oregon grant and received that grant to redo the runway. Subsequently, it was redone in 2013. There was a subsequent grant to do some more improvements to the runway property, and that happened in 2015. The taxes from 2000 to 2013 to 2014 went up by tenfold, from $600 to $7,100. We're not talking about the entire airport property, and I want to make that very clear that we're talking about simply a 250-foot by 3,600-foot strip down the middle of which is a piece of asphalt. No buildings, no other improvements except asphalt. So in that handout, the crosshatched portion is the commercial part of the airport. The public use portion is a separate entity. It's a not-for-profit corporation, and that's what I'm looking for tax abatement for. Most of the other airports in the state, and I just came from a meeting with Oregon Department of Aviation, they would like to see the wording in the outline changed a little bit to the Department of Revenue, in coordination with the Department of Aviation, shall conduct a study. And then the question became the airport property. It's, in this case, it's the public use portion of the airport property. I'd be happy to take any questions at this point. I don't know how much information you'd like about this particular airport. I think it's pretty typical of an east of the mountain airport. We support life flight, firefighting, charter flights. So a lot of tourism dollars come through the Sisters Airport. The designation for Sisters is similar to several other airports. Sun River is a good example, where their public use airports that are privately owned. As such, they're not eligible for, normally for city, county, state, federal funding, other than grant requests or our wallets.
Well, I congratulate you on the Connect Oregon grant.
Thank you.
Our staff tells us no other airports get this kind of designation for property taxes. So can you elaborate on what makes this situation more compelling?
Well, I think the compelling argument for me, Chairman Haas, is this. The airport was improved with public money, and not for the benefit of the airport ownership, but for the benefit of the public as a piece of public infrastructure. In that case, the taxing authority or the ad valorem taxes on that piece of property are essentially a clawback to that grant money. So we're being taxed on public money, which is all well and good if there's a profit margin to the owner or if there's something else going on, but we're obligated for the next 20 years through the grant assurances to keep that an airport, to maintain the asphalt, to maintain the airport designation, and to pay property taxes on public infrastructure just doesn't seem to be fair, to not put a too fine a point on it. And it's outside what is normal for other airports. You have 97 state airports, none of whom are paying property taxes on their transportation infrastructure.
When these aircraft use your airport, do you sell them fuel or do you charge them fees?
We charge an overnight parking fee, Chairman Haas. We do not. We sell fuel. We sell fuel at very close to cost just because it's out of the way, and that's the way we'd prefer to do that. So, yes, there is. The fueling station, however, is on the commercial portion of the property. Not that that makes any difference. So yes, we do profit from fuel sales. We also take about a $20,000 a year loss on that piece of asphalt, taxes, snow removal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there are some expenses associated with that public use infrastructure that we're obligated to fulfill, and they're not profitable. Okay. Taxes is the big gorilla.
Other questions? Senator Riley?
So how much use of that public airport does this private company sitting on the airport on the runway use? How much do they use it?
Chairman Hass, Senator Riley, the company, the people that own the airport also own an engineering firm which is based at the airport. Not on the runway, obviously, but on the commercial portion of the airport. They fly regularly for business, but to quantify that, if we're talking about number of flights, maybe one a week.
So, so where's the closest airport to this airport?
The closest airport is the Redmond Commercial Airport. It's 18 miles to the north, northeast.
So this saves them a lot of this engineering company that's on the airport, the owners of the this property and the runway, significant time and money. Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions?
Senator Benz? So can you give us a glimpse of how much of this airport is used publicly and how much is used just by private folks using it to land?
Senator Benz, all of the runway is always used. It's a general aviation airport, so it's not commercial in any sense. The folks that own the airport fly out of it occasionally. There are locals that fly out of it occasionally. We have hangars on the commercial side of the airport. So they fly out of it. There's a flight school there. In fact, the flight school is one of only three in the country that teaches high school kids to fly through a program at Sisters High School. So it gets a fair amount of use, but it's all public use, I guess. I mean, it's not for-profit, private use, maybe with the exception of Benny's Flights for Business, but I'm not sure that I understand exactly where you're trying to go here.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I was getting at is it used for firefighting purposes?
I'm sorry, yes.
Is it used for air ambulance purposes?
Yes.
Is it used for other purposes that have everything to do with serving the public, not private interests?
Yes.
Your high school example is a good one.
Yeah.
So maybe you can give us a list of the types of, when I use the word public, I don't mean open to the public, I mean government, let's say, or...
Okay.
Collective interests.
Yeah. Chairman Hass, Senator Benz, to elaborate, the Sisters Airport, first of all, is the first airport east of the Cascades. So for emergency services coming from the valley or a pilot in trouble, it's the first. So there's a use, and it's been used for that. It's routinely used for firefighting, both by the Forest Service and Oregon Department of Forestry. It's used for wildlife counts. In fact, they were there a couple weeks ago doing elk counts. That's ODF&W, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. They use it. Air ambulance uses it both for transport to take a patient from an ambulance and fly them to a hospital, or they may use it for a staging area to land, get their bearings, figure out what's going on, and then they land either in the National Forest or on the highway up towards Santa Ana Pass. That's happened. Fortunately, that doesn't happen very often, but it happens half a dozen times a year, maybe a little bit more. We do have the facility for them to have lights, access to buildings if they come in after hours, and the local fire folks know how to do that. The firefighting, depending on the year, we've had as many as 6 different firefighting aircraft there at once. We've got a little campground that the fire crews can camp in, and they're there for anywhere from a day to 14 days, 2 weeks. So yes, the public uses the airport routinely. Civil Air Patrol uses it for training, for short field training. The Forest Service actually uses it for training also, for some of their aircraft that fly paratroopers. It does get used by the public.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. So I just want to, this is a new subject area for me, so I don't know, maybe it, Jamie, you can help us with this. Is trying to understand, I asked if there was a, what the definition was of a public airport that is privately owned. And so there's a list here of these airports, but I just wondered if there was something in statute or how that works that says what makes it so that it's public. And then I just wondering how these other airports are treated in regard to property taxes. I don't, it sounds like you're doing a lot of great things there. I just wanted to understand some of those things so there was fair treatment.
Thank you, Senator Taylor, members of the committee. So I did ask the Department of Revenue for the if there was a statutorily defined term, public use private airports. And I did get back a list of, I don't know, approximately 10 or 15 airports that sort of fit that characteristic. My understanding is from this airport as well as other airports, this case there is a grant involved, but other airports that have sort of right of way for emergency services, fire, and 911 kind of services. I did ask the Department of Revenue if there's a term, and I got that list. I know the Department of Revenue is here, but I'm not certain that there's a definition in statute for public, private, publicly used private airports. It's my understanding from talking to the counties that that those airports all pay, if they're private, they pay taxes on the private property. Of course, the property taxes that are assessed are depending on the county and the rates in the county and those sorts of things, and the maximum assessed value and those sorts of things.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chairman Hess, Senator Taylor, if I can just elaborate on that. The Oregon Department of Aviation classifies airports as private or private with public use, or private-private, or commercial, or so, or municipal. It's my understanding that the runway portions of a public use airport are not subject to property tax in Oregon because they are considered part of the transportation infrastructure. So it's like streets, if that helps. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Senator Benz?
None.
All right. Well, we thank you for coming down here.
Sure.
And
talking for having me.
I do have Marcia Kelly signed up to testify on Senate Bill 850.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, Marcia Kelly, the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Deschutes County is where I was born. I was born in Bend, so I have a soft spot in my heart for things that happen in Bend. This is not one of the soft spots in my heart, however. It sounds like a really nice thing to give away property taxes for the company that owns the Sisters Airport. They did, in fact, receive Connect Oregon grants. I have not been able to find out what the status of the court case is where ODOT is trying to retrieve the money for the grants because of inappropriate spending. That court case was filed in... ODOT negotiated for a year. The company filed a court case against ODOT, and ODOT countersued. But I haven't, because I just found out that the amendment was going to just go ahead and not have a study, but just go ahead and give away property taxes. I haven't been able to locate the status of that court case. And so I think that it's something that one needs to think about before giving away property taxes. I also think that because the state of Oregon has invested a great deal of money in the airport, that it seems only logical that the private uses, not the runway, would be taxed, just like any other privately owned piece of company would be.
Questions? Doug Riggs.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We're the nine cities in Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County, plus Maupin. And we've been around for 20 years. In fact, this is our 20th anniversary in the building, and we're happy to be here to continue to support economic development issues. We have been a close supporter of airport uses throughout Central Oregon. The City of Sisters and Central Oregon City supported the Connect Oregon grant application of the Sisters Airport and also the Prineville Airport, the Madras Airport, the Redmond Airport, and the Bend Airport. And we believe that Connect Oregon money has done great things for economic development in Central Oregon, not just for airports, but for other issues as well. We have noticed Senate Bill 850. We've been kind of watching it. I had it on my tracking list. It was a study to take a look at the benefit of doing something like this. And we fully expected to be involved in whatever that study in the interim would be. And then last night at about 5:59 p.m., this amendment was posted, and it went from a study to an immediate waiver of property taxes for this specific facility. This was the first that the City of Sisters had heard of the amendment. We had not been contacted by the proponents of the amendment up to that point, and I've talked to the city managers, also talked to the mayor and the other staff. Now, this may or may not be sound policy, and it may or may not set a precedent that we want to copy elsewhere. And I agree with the proponent of the measure that it's a small amount of property tax revenue. But it definitely impacts not just the city revenue, property tax revenue, and the county property tax revenue. But I think it needs to be viewed in the context of property tax revenue for school districts, for police and fire and safety, for park districts elsewhere, et cetera. So, in general, I think we would have preferred to have this conversation prior to this legislative hearing today. The city is willing to host a meeting with the proponents of the bill and the other impacted property tax jurisdictions in the region. We are not necessarily opposed to the bill, and we might end up being supportive of the bill. I can't tell you one way or the other, but we don't think that we have enough information at this point to make a determination either pro or con on this particular amendment. If the committee wanted to go back to the underlying base bill of a study, I think that might be a good way to start and a good place to start. And again, the city and the Central Oregon Cities organization would be more than happy to sit down and have the conversation. Airports are important, as I said at the outset of my testimony. The economic development benefits of airports, the firefighting benefits of airports, the public benefits of airports aren't questioned by my clients, and we certainly understand and appreciate the value of airports. But we do need to make sure that this doesn't become a precedent that limits property tax revenues from cities that are struggling from a variety of issues and school districts that are facing compression, et cetera. And so for that reason, we'd like to have a little more time to take a look at this and talk with the proponents before making a final decision. So thank you very much.
Appreciate that, Doug. Questions? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else signed up on this bill? Senator Benz? I think that clears us out until tomorrow. So thank you all. We are adjourned.